The following sermon was recorded at Pipe Creek Community Church in Pipe Creek, Texas. For more information, visit our website at pipecreekcc.com. May God bless you as you study His Word.
From time to time, as we move through the sermon series in the Gospel of John, I would remind you of how God presents redemption in the Old Testament, and as we move through to the New Testament and to our Savior Jesus being born and living a life in our place and dying the death we deserve to die and being risen in glory. As we move through redemptive history, the way that God presents redemption over and over again is He presents redemption this way. He presents man's sin as being so great that God must save us. Man's sin is so great, God must save us. And His promises are so great that only God can fulfill them. In redemption, man's sin is so great, God must do it. And God's promises are so great, only God can do it. Over and over again, that's the picture you see of redemption. And in the book of Daniel, you see one of the things that God is doing with all the questions that need to be answered for the exiles. Is our God the true God? Is our God going to forgive us? Is He going to bring us out? Is He more powerful than the other gods? Is one God just as good as another God? How does this work? And in Daniel, those questions are answered, and amongst the greatest questions answered is the uniqueness of the one true God. There is only one true God, and the God that we worship and serve is He. And there's none like Him. None can compare. And He's constantly in the book of Daniel putting Himself on display to make it so that no one could argue that point. In Isaiah's chapters 40 through 45, you see the trial of the false gods, where God comes before, calls all the pagan gods to Himself, the false gods, all those people groups, all the nations, including His own people Israel, who've been tempted and lured to worship idols themselves. And God establishes that He's the only true God, and He does so by saying, I'm the only one who can tell you what's going to happen in the future. And I'm the only one who can tell you about the events of the past, what their purpose was. That's how He sets Himself apart. I'm the only one who knows the future, and I'm the only one who can tell you the purpose for everything that's ever happened. And of course, the false gods, false idols, are silent. Amen. And that's what we're going to see this morning in Daniel, especially now as we move through Daniel. We're going to see this more and more as God putting Himself on display, His uniqueness on display. And this morning He's going to do it by bringing trouble to a king. He's going to bring a king troubling dreams as a way not only to start to work in this king's heart, which He is starting to work in this king's heart, but also as a way to set Himself apart, put Himself on display. As we move through Daniel, one of the things that I'm going to continue to do is I'm going to continue to go to Jeremiah. What I have found is the greatest commentary to the book of Daniel is actually Jeremiah. They are prophets at the same time, if you will. Jeremiah is prophesying back in Jerusalem. And in chapter 24, he prophesies something, or he gives Jeremiah a vision, which if he wouldn't have given, Jeremiah would never have believed. He gives him a vision of two baskets of figs. A basket of good figs, very good figs. And a basket of bad figs, very bad figs. And it's important because when we are in exile, as the people of God are here, being exiled and ruled, we think that this is a bad time and that they are in a very, very bad place. But when Jeremiah gets this vision in chapter 24 and he understands it, this is what he prophesies. He says that what God says is the very, very bad figs are in Jerusalem. And my remnant, my people, the very, very good figs are the ones I have taken to Babylon. That's my remnant. Those are my people. The ones in Babylon are my people. The ones left back in Jerusalem are the bad figs. In other words, yes, they are in a very, very bad place, and this is a very, very bad time, but I've got work for them to do there. I've got a plan. They are going to be fruitful there. I am going to be fruitful through them. I'm going to use them as a means to redeem. I'm going to use them as a way to change the world. And he's working through Daniel and his friends to do that very thing. Yes, they are in exile, but they're the people that God is preserving and protecting. And he's preserving them and protecting them in Babylon, while at the same time, he's nurturing them and strengthening them and transforming them as he uses them to transform others. Can you and I be faithful and fruitful in Babylon? Can you and I live in a fallen world, increasingly secular, increasingly antagonistic towards God, or even worse, indifferent towards Him? Can you and I live in this world and can not only just remain faithful, but can we be faithful and fruitful? That's what God called the exiles in Babylon to be, both faithful and fruitful. That's what he calls us to be as well. So as God puts himself on display, shows his uniqueness amongst all the other gods. And matter of fact, chapter 2 ends with Nebuchadnezzar saying, "Your God is the God of gods." Yes, he is. He is the God of gods. So he's going to do that through bringing nightmares to a very powerful king. So we're going to see 3 points this morning as we look at God putting himself on display and his uniqueness on display. We're going to see God doing it through the troubled, through the trusting, and then showing that he is himself the one true God. Okay? The troubled, the trusting, and the one true God. First, the troubled. King Nebuchadnezzar is the troubled one, right? Verse 1, he had dreams, and his spirit is troubled, and his sleep left him. Verse 2, the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and Chaldeans are all called in. Verse 3, once again, I had a dream, he says to them, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. He's troubled. He can't sleep at night. He is sovereign. Oh, he is the most powerful sovereign ruler, human ruler in the world at the time, but he's not sovereign over his own bed. He is the most powerful man in the world at this moment. People obey his orders or they die. Yet he doesn't know the thoughts of his own mind. He's troubled. He's very troubled. And so he calls in magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, Chaldeans. These words all mean something a little different. Magicians are like scholars, or they're like skilled problem solvers. It can mean dark magic, but also it can just mean knowledgeable. They got all these big books of Babylonian history they look through, and they can tell you why things are happening the way they are. These are the magicians. And then you have enchanters. These are people that say they can speak to the dead. You might have translated astrologers. They could speak to the dead. They also look to the stars and tell the future, or so they say. Then you have the sorcerers. These are people that practice divination and incantation. They say they can produce reality with their speech. Kind of sound like name it and claim it, almost. Okay, Babylonian style. TBN. Babylonian style, right? You don't know what I'm talking about. I'm sorry, that was a little joke. Chaldeans. The Chaldeans are the special group. They are the ruling elites, okay? They are like a group of priests, Babylonian priests, if you will. They're the elite ruling class. They are there to preserve beliefs, religious beliefs, and preserve culture. They are there to identify another god that they've found and rightly worship the gods they have already found. These men are supposed to have answers to all of life's greatest questions. They're supposed to have answers to life's deepest mysteries. They're supposed to understand the natural world and the supernatural world. So Nebuchadnezzar is a troubled man. He is having dreams. Notice, dreams, plural. Many dreams, right? He's having dreams in verse 1. And then in verse 3 he says, I had a dream. So in other words, what Nebuchadnezzar is saying is, I keep having the same dream over and over and over again. Many dreams, but it's just this dream, and this is what it is. You tell me what it is. He doesn't just say, I'm having a dream, let me tell you what it is, and then you tell me what it means. It's not what he says. He says, you tell me what the dream is, and tell me the interpretation. But he keeps on having the same dream over and over again, and he does what he knows to do. He does what his father before him did. He does what he's been always been trained to do. He does what our rulers today do. He goes to the top. Harvard faculty. Appoint a czar. Right? A blue ribbon commission. That's what Nebuchadnezzar does. He goes to the top. And he finds no help there. The world can't help him. They have gotten no answers. Verse 4, his cabinet's before him. O king, live forever. O king, live forever. Tell us the dream and we'll show the interpretation. But the king is saying, you have to tell me the dream first. Look, the king is on to these guys. No, we're not going to fake this one, boys. This one's actually important. Okay, this is not we're deciding whether or not we should attack today in battle or something like that. This is actually important. We're talking about my kingdom here. We're talking about my future. And he's very troubled and very insecure about it. We can't play the games this time. Religious games are all fine and good unless we're getting serious about me personally. So he's on to them. Tell me the dream and its interpretation. He reiterates this in verses 8 and 9 as well. And in verse 10 and 11, they say, as they've already said once before, no one can do that. No man can do what you're asking. Not just that, but no king has ever even asked that. Like they've looked up Babylonian history right quick. Nobody's even ever asked that. That's impossible. So, they need a little motivation. So, this is how he motivates them. Verse 5 and 6. You shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses will be laid in ruins if you can't do this. But if you can, I will give you great rewards and honor. Great punishment, great reward. Okay, that's how he's going to motivate them. That is the only way he knows how. That's the only way he knows how to motivate these men. Why is that? All religions, false religions, work this way. It is relationship with God totally governed by fear. And therefore, every other relationship is that way. Fear and punishment. None of them really trust the Babylonian gods they pretend to serve, and none of them trust one another. These men don't trust him, and he sure as heck doesn't trust them, because they're all faking it. These magicians know they can't do magic. They know they can't do what he's calling them to do. Nobody can. He knows they know. They know he knows. There's no trust. This is how their whole culture is run. But look, he's used to getting action when he threatens, because he's the most powerful man in the world. When he says, I'm going to lay your house to ruins, that's not an idle threat. He's going to do that. He can do that. He can make a man rich if he wants to. He can put a man to death if he wants to, just by his command. He's in control. He is the law. But when this is impossible. No amount of motivating them is going to make this happen, because they can't do this. They're frauds. They're almost acknowledging themselves to be frauds. So why is Nebuchadnezzar asking for something? I say all that to set this up. Why is he asking for something that nobody has ever asked for before? Why is this such an issue? Surely he has called them together to ask them questions before. What is it about this? He has already decreed it. By the time you get to verse 12, he's already ordered it. Firing squads are out. Okay? Pitchforks and fires are being set on houses. He's after them. The wise men are running for their lives. What is it about this? First of all, the issue is God's working. Okay, let's acknowledge that. God is working. God is going to bring this man, he's going to humble this man and bring from him a great confession in chapter 4. And verse 28, Daniel says, God has made known these things to you to tell you what's going to happen. So who's sending the dreams? God is doing it. Why is he so troubled? Because when you're messed up, when you are self-sufficient and self-righteous and prideful and power-hungry and living in accordance with false gods, and God's after you, you're going to be troubled. God's after his heart, so he's going to be troubled. So that's what God is doing. But second of all, and this is what I want you to see even more so than that, the king is having a difficulty with this because he's seeing what's going to happen in the future. He doesn't understand exactly what it means, but he understands it has to do with his kingdom and his whole identity and his whole person, his very self is tethered to what happens in this world and what happens with that kingdom. If this kingdom goes down, so does he. This kingdom is his righteousness. It's how he knows he is somebody. And so it's not just a political issue for him. It's his very self that's under attack. And that's why he's so furious. And that's why today we're not going to fake it, boys. I'm going to make sure I get a true answer from you. And this is how I'm going to do it. You're going to have to tell me what the dream even is. And if I have to kill wise men on a regular basis till I get it done, that's what I'm going to do. Okay, that is King Nebuchadnezzar here. He is very troubled. He's the most powerful man in the world, and he is the most fragile and fearful man in the world. Because when you hitch your whole life to something in this world, you are always going to be fearful and fragile. Always. Any day it could go down. Any day somebody could take it from you. You spent your whole life getting it. Now you're going to spend your whole life keeping it. And that's where he is. Of course he's angry. Of course he is anxious. This is his whole life. And ancient Babylon, which invented time, which invented the sailboat, which invented the chariot, and not to mention the hanging gardens of Babylon, none of them, is even as technologically advanced and smart as these people are, none of them can do this. Only God could do this. And the God they serve isn't the real God. And so he's troubled. They say, O king, live forever. He's not going to live forever. He's going to die. You and I are going too. Right? When they say, O king, live forever, he's not going to, and neither is that kingdom. And whatever kingdom you're building, it's going down too. You're going to die. Are you ready? He's desperate. But please recognize, what is he so desperate for? Truth! Reality! He's starving for truth and reality. And now it's desperate. And he's got to have it. Do you understand that if you don't have truth, you won't rest? No truth equals no rest. He is starving for something real. He is sick to death of the magicians. He's after something. Somebody show me something that will show me that this is real. It's not real. He knows it's not real. And he's struggling. What is he to do? So he's going to lash out. He's going to start killing men. It's the only thing he knows to do. He is sick of calling the TV show that promises you if you sow $45.45 of faith to my ministry, I'm going to send you a blessing. He's sick of that. And that's exactly what this kind of stuff is. It's this prosperity nonsense. He is sick and tired of being told what they know he wants to hear. Give me some truth. Give me some reality. Please give me something real. Nothing in Nebuchadnezzar's life is real. They say, O king, live forever. Do they care about him? No, they're afraid of him. Even his own kingdom isn't really real. It's going. It's a breath. So, this is his predicament. And his experts, his top brass, his best of the best, are impotent, useless. What good are you if you can't do this, he says to them. They're of no use. This is the beginning of God working. Listen, throughout Scripture and in your life, this is how God works. He's going to show you the lie of self-sufficiency. You know that God is working in your heart when you start to recognize, I can't do it. The lie of self-sufficiency, his eyes are being opened to it. And he's recognizing, secondly, the world can't help. I can't do it, and this world, nobody in this world can help me. The lie of self-sufficiency in the world is of no use. This is God working. He's not in control of his own life. He doesn't even know the thoughts of his own mind. He's out of control. So he's troubled. Secondly, the trusting. The king is troubled. Daniel and his friends are trusting. They're the ones who are trusting. A decree goes out, verse 12 and 13. All the wise men will be destroyed. So they sought Daniel and his companions. They're after him. They're going to kill them. So notice what we're going to get here. We're going to get an opportunity to see the contrast between a troubled man who doesn't know God, and other men who are going through their own adversity, like their life is hanging in the balance. And instead of being troubled, they're trusting. And we're going to get to see this contrast here between Daniel and his friends and the king. Daniel is and his companions are trusting. This is what a man of God looks like as he's trusting God. Verse 17 and 18. What does he do first? He makes it known to other believers. Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. Hey, this is what's going on, boys. Pray. pray to God for mercy. He told them, seek mercy from the God of heaven. First of all, recognize he uses their Hebrew names. Remember, their Hebrew names are all symbolic, are all recognition of their connection to God. So, of course, they're going to live that out and they're going to pray to God. They're living up to their names. Notice the difference between Daniel and the king. The king goes to men. Daniel and his friends go to God. Secondly, they're recognizing God as a God of grace and mercy, who is in control and supreme. Seek the God of mercy, who is the God of heaven. This God of heaven language is, it's bringing out the sovereignty and the supremacy of God. He's not just the God of earth. He's God over all. He's the God of heaven. He's in control. He knows all things. And he's a God of mercy. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar doesn't trust a God. Daniel and his friends absolutely trust God. They don't say, hey God, we are good men who deserve it. No, they seek mercy. We don't deserve anything, but be merciful to us. This is the God they know. This is how they understand God. Verse 18. They also understand that he's not a God they control with their actions. Listen, every religion on earth apart from the gospel is religion in which I control God by my works. My life is the way that I control God. If I'm very, very good, then God has to bless me. And if I'm very, very bad, then God gets to punish me. That's every other religion on earth. The unique God has relationship with his people through his only Son in the gospel, which is, you don't control him. You don't control this God. You're saved by grace. You're saved by grace means he can ask anything he wants of you. You are his by his grace, not by anything you have done. You will remain his by his grace, not by anything you do. You can't control this God. All you can do is pray to him. Seek his mercy. And he's going to work. He's going to do what he's going to do. Do you see how different these two approaches are? Third, notice that Daniel's at rest. Verse 19, God reveals to Daniel in a vision of the night. That means that Daniel goes to sleep. Nebuchadnezzar has power over all, can't sleep. Daniel is life hanging in the balance, and he goes right to sleep. This is a man of God trusting God. There is no rest if there is no truth. If there is objective truth in reality in relationship with God, then there's rest. And Daniel experiences that rest. As a matter of fact, he never gets the vision if he doesn't go to sleep. He does. Fourthly, recognize this. They all prayed. It was a community prayer. Even, I don't know if they prayed it all together, but they're all praying, and Daniel gets the vision. Everybody's praying, one man gets the vision. Not every man for himself, like the king and his cabinet. It is, let's all pray, and then Daniel gets the vision. Everybody prays for this one thing, and Daniel gets it. It's how we work. We pray together. And God works, how he works. But it begins with everybody together. It's community. And then it moves to one person. And finally, in verses 20 through 23, we get this wonderful prayer of praise. It's really a doxology. And notice, in contrast to the king, For Daniel, in this prayer of praise, it's not about him at all. For the king, it's about keeping his power. He wants answers from the gods for his power, for himself. In this prayer of praise, Daniel doesn't even mention, hardly even mention the situation. You know what he does in this prayer of praise? He just prays back to God all the characteristics of God that have been put on display in the way that God has answered the prayer. That is amazing. I am thankful not that I am not dead, as much as I am thankful that you put yourself on display in all these ways in answering this prayer. You are then blessed be the name of God who belong wisdom and might, changes times and season, removes kings and sets up kings. Wisdom gives wisdom to the wise, knowledge to those who have understanding, reveals things. All these things that are the characteristics of God, aspects of who He is, put on display in the way that He's interacting with Daniel. His prayer of praise is pointed and it's personal. It's aimed at the specific characteristics of God, but it's all about, I praise you. I praise you. It's very personal, but it's very, very much about God. And note how it plays itself out in his life. Verse 26, the king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation? Yes, I am able to do that. I have a spiritual gift that puffs me up. It's not what he said. He says, no, I'm not able to do that. Verse 27. Verse 28. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. I can't do it. It's not me doing it. It's God doing it. And he gets an opportunity to point to God, to glorify God. He's always looking for an opportunity to do that. And then he goes before the king. And you see this amazing, at the same time, you see this humility and boldness in Daniel that exist in him at the same time. He comes before the king. To you, O king, as you lay in bed, came thoughts of what would be after this. And he who reveals mysteries made known to you what it is to be. But as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because of any wisdom that I have more than all the living. Recognize how humble he is. It's not me, it's God. It's God doing this, not me. But in order that the interpretation may be made known to the king, that you may know the thoughts of your mind. Daniel says, Daniel does not say, is this the dream that you had? Is this right? He doesn't say, if you don't change your ways, this is what's going to happen. He says, this is what's going to happen. That's it. Period. The God who is in control that you don't know has decreed that this is what's going to happen. In the future, this is what's going to happen. That's it. Boldness, courage, absolute humility at the same time. Before we move to the last point, recognize the relationship between mercy and revelation. Between mercy and revelation. See the connection between mercy and wisdom and revelation. Wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of the Lord means God is ultimate and I am dependent upon Him and everything that I ask of Him is an ask of mercy. Right? And those are the people that get the wisdom. And revelation is what? An act of mercy. Be merciful to us, O God, and let us know. All revelation is an act of mercy. God has been merciful to let us know. To make himself known. To the great questions of life that these men cannot answer, the Bible can answer. It can tell you these answers, and it does so all the way through in Christ. As he makes himself known. But apart from revelation, apart from the mercy of his revelation, we would never know. Finally, the only true God, quickly. I'm going to just point out three things. He is the only God of grace, first of all. He's the only God of grace. Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. Verse 22, He reveals deep and hidden things. He reveals. Nebuchadnezzar wasn't asking for God. He's a God of grace. Means God is breaking in to Nebuchadnezzar's life. He's breaking into his nightmares, if you will. But it didn't start with Nebuchadnezzar saying, God, show me. It began with God coming in, breaking in, interceding. God is the initiating God. He's a God of grace. If you know Him, it's because He came and got you. He revealed Himself to you. He's a God of grace. Now, once again, the Babylonian gods, just like all other false gods, are going to react to the person's actions. They're not going to initiate by grace. Secondly, He's the only God in control. He's absolutely in control. He appoints kings and takes them out. Puts them on the throne, takes them off. He's done it with Assyria. He's going to do it with Babylon. Then He's going to do it with Greece. Or then He's going to do it with the Persians. Then He's going to do it with Greece. Then He's going to do it with Rome. He's going to do it. He is sovereign. He appoints seasons and times. He is absolutely sovereign and He's absolutely in control. He's the only true God. He's the only one who knows what He's going to bring to pass. And He's the only one who knows the purpose for everything that's ever happened. Finally, He's the only God who reveals. He is the revealing God. It's not, there are mysteries that God has kept. Here in this book, mysteries do not mean things that we have to find out. Mysteries here in Daniel throughout the New Testament are things that are going to happen but haven't happened yet. And here God is revealing mysteries about what's going to happen with His Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom. In the New Testament, He reveals the mystery of the gospel through Christ. We are saved by grace. But He is the one who reveals. He's the only God who reveals, who makes Himself known. It's not enough just to be a part of a club, to be a part of a certain atmosphere, or to claim to believe in the same tenets as everybody else. He reveals Himself so you can have a relationship with Him. Utterly unique. Condescends, makes Himself known so He can know you. Finally, recognize this. So much we could say about this, but let's stop right here. What does Nebuchadnezzar need? He needs Jesus. He needs Jesus. Notice what the Chaldeans say. They say to Him, show us a dream and we'll reveal it to you. And the king answers, says, certainly not. You're just trying to trick me. You're trying to buy time. Verse 10, the Chaldeans say this, there is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. No great and powerful king has ever asked such a thing of any magician. The thing that the king asks is difficult. No one can show it to the king except gods. Except the gods. Whose dwelling is not with flesh. There is a God. There is a God who became flesh and dwelt among us. And in doing so, He made God known, revealed God. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't even know it. But in the responses of his trusted advisors, he's realizing, without knowing it, the one he needs is Jesus. He needs what only God can give, and he needs that God to come in the flesh and give it so he can know it. And that's exactly what Jesus did. He came wrapped in flesh. In a few weeks, we're celebrating his birth, and that's what Christmas is about. He came, became just like us and nothing like us at the same time, so that he might reveal God to us, so that he might do everything that we must do and can't, and die the death that we must die, so that we could have a relationship with God. Nebuchadnezzar needs Jesus. So do you. Do you know him? Are you faking it? Are you playing religious games? Are you hungry for what is true and real? It's my prayer this morning that if you don't really know Jesus, that God, to some degree, would bring trouble into your own heart to make you seek him. Nebuchadnezzar doesn't even recognize what's going on yet. He's busy trying to keep his kingdom and his pride and his power. But God's working on his heart and making him a seeker. He's recognizing the fragility of his own life and the fact that this world can't help him with what he most needs. And this world doesn't have the answers. But there is a God who does. Let us seek him.